Presenters. We're going to start today's presentation with some opening remarks by Roger Hoogerheide. He's joining us from EPA Region 8, where he serves as a remedial project manager at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. He has a master's in environmental sciences and has worked for EPA for over 20 years in Washington, D.C., Denver, Colorado, and the Helena, Montana offices. He's currently overseeing remediation at a number of Superfund sites in Montana, including two lead and zinc mining district sites. Next, we'll be joined by Dr. Edward Kavazangian, who is the director for the Center for Biomediated and Bioinspired Geotechnics. He is a Regents Professor and the IRA Fulton Professor of Geotechnical Engineering in the School of Sustainable Engineering and the Built Environment at Arizona State University in Tempe, Arizona. He joined the faculty there in 2004 after 20 years as a practicing geotechnical engineer. He also has a bachelor's and master's of science in civil engineering from MIT and a PhD in geotechnical engineering from the University of California in Berkeley. We will then be following with a presentation by Dr. Rosa Krashmalnik, where she is a professor at the School of Sustainable Engineering and the Built Environment and the SWET Center for Environmental Biotechnology at Arizona State University. She has a PhD in environmental engineering from Georgia Tech, and she was also awarded an NSF Career Award, where she was selected one of 40 under 40 leaders in Phoenix. She has funding for her research from many federal agencies, including NIH, DOE, DOD, and the National Science Foundation. She leads a thrust in the Center for Biomediated and Bioinspired Geotechnics, which is an NSF-funded engineering research center. And then we'll close out with a presentation from Dr. Anca Delgado, where she's a senior investigator at the Center for Biomediated and Bioinspired Geotechnics. She received her PhD in microbiology from Arizona State University and is currently an assistant professor of environmental engineering in the School of Sustainable Engineering and the Built Environment and the Biodesign SWET Center for Environmental Biotechnology. She is a principal investigator in the NSF-sponsored center, as well as has a lot of expertise in soil and groundwater microbial processes that transform or sequester carbon and chlorine-containing compounds to remediate contaminants and improve soil quality. So with those introductions, let me turn things over to our very first speaker, Roger, to provide his opening remarks. Roger?
Thanks, Jean. Before I begin our remarks, I do want to give a thanks for Jean for all the work that she does behind the scenes to make these Clue-In webinars happen. And Jean, I appreciate everything that you do. So as Jean mentioned, I have several Superfund sites that I work on in the state of Montana. And at one of the sites, one of the respondents that we're working with is an industry partner with the Center for Biomediated and Bioinspired Geotechnics. And they were very instrumental in getting EPA to become a partner, an industry partner, which Ed will talk about in his presentation in a little bit. As part of becoming a partner, I was able to tour CBBG this past July and meet with some of the researchers. I found that their research that they're doing is cutting edge, and it had a lot of applications to the work that I do, as well as other RPMs and consultants in the environmental remediation field. And I asked if they would do a Clue-In webinar just to introduce everybody to what the CBBG is and an in-depth discussion of a particular type of research. And in particular, they're going to look at research of chlorinated solvents. So with that, Ed, I'd like you to begin your presentation and kind of discuss what CBBG is.
Thank you, Roger and Jean. I appreciate the kind introduction, and thank you for this opportunity to tell everyone a little bit about our center, the research and development work we're doing on environmental protection. So let's just start with, a little background on what our center is all about. Basically, we're focusing on an emerging sub-discipline in the geotechnical engineering field that is collectively referred to as biogeotechnical engineering, and it's composed of two different aspects. We look at biomediated processes, which are processes that are managed and controlled through biological activity, i.e. living organisms, microorganisms in the subsurface mostly. And we also look at bio-inspired processes, where we take biological principles and use them to develop new abiotic solutions to geotechnical problems. And when we talk about bio-inspired, we like to look at the entire biosphere. So it may be an abiotic natural process, but if it's a natural process, we consider that within our purview. The premise that we're operating on is a very similar premise that lots of other fields are using in what's broadly referred to sometimes as biomimicry, and that is that through billions of years of essentially trial and error, nature has developed many elegant and efficient biogeotechnical processes, and that these processes can be used to build, maintain, and renew sustainable and resilient geotechnical systems. So our goal is to learn to identify these processes and then learn from nature how we can mobilize them for beneficial use. And the challenge we face once we've identified these processes can fall into two different categories. Sometimes we'll identify a process that occurs over geologic time, for instance, cementation of sort of transition of sand to sandstone, and we look to see how we can accelerate these beneficial processes to occur in a time frame of interest. Other times, we might identify adverse processes that operate in the time frame of interest. For instance, clogging of monitoring wells, clogging of water treatment plant filters by carbonate precipitation. And our challenge is to try and induce these same processes in a context in which they're beneficial, for instance, for strengthening sands. How are we managing this? Well, we do it through our center, the Center for Biomediated and Bioinspired Geotechnics, or CBBG. We are an NSF, National Science Foundation Engineering Research Center, dedicated to nature-inspired geotechnical solutions to civil infrastructure problems. We have four thrusts: hazard mitigation, environmental protection, which is mostly what I'll talk about today, infrastructure construction, and subsurface exploration and excavation. We are a consortium of four public universities. Arizona State University is in the lead, but our partners include UC Davis, Georgia Tech, and New Mexico State. We focus on both research and education, including workforce development issues on the education side. And we do have a very broad industry partnership program. The NSF Engineering Research Center program deviates from traditional NSF research in that rather than being focused on basic research, which is most NSF research, the ERC program is focused on collaborating with industry to develop solutions that can be readily deployed in the field. And so we have an industry partnership program that covers the value chain in infrastructure, including owners, contractors, engineering architecture firms, consultants, and government agencies. And our industry partners guide us on strategic planning in the center and also collaborate with us directly on research. So I mentioned we have four thrusts, just some little tidbits. We have over 20 active projects in the center. In environmental protection and restoration, we focus on soil and groundwater remediation, and we're also doing some innovative work on restoring the microbial crust. I'll talk about that a little bit later. In infrastructure construction, a lot of the work is on traditional infrastructure issues such as foundation design, but from an environmental perspective, we also have a project on mitigating fugitive dust and on surface water erosion control. In hazard mitigation, our primary focus is on mitigating earthquake-induced soil liquefaction by precipitation in the minerals and generating biogas, or desaturating the soil. And these technologies also have some environmental applications. And then in subsurface excavation and exploration, one of the things we're doing is developing motile or self-boring probes that we can put in the ground and let them go off on their own collecting information for us as a way to facilitate subsurface investigation and characterization. I mentioned the industry partner program. They provide us input on strategic direction and collaborate with us on research and development. We now, I believe, have 23 industry partners. You see EPA there in the center of our industry partner universe, but these are some of the other organizations that are that partner with CBBG. So mostly I want to talk about our environmental protection and restoration research. And you might find it interesting when we first started the center or when we were being evaluated, our proposal was being evaluated by EPA, one of the reviewers expressed the concern that there might not be anything transformative left to do in environmental remediation, and perhaps we shouldn't have it as part of the purview of our center. Hopefully we put that to rest over the last 4 years with the research we've been doing and some of the innovative environmental techniques that we're working on include a process we call microbial metabolic exploration, where we're looking at microbes in extreme environments to understand what they do and see if we can put them to beneficial use, remediation of metals and metalloids, co-precipitation of contaminants with calcite, metabolic chain elongation, which is the process by which small chain hydrocarbons combine to create intermediate length hydrocarbons and in the process generate energy that can be used for bioremediation and microbial crust restoration. And I'll give you a few tidbits on these projects before Anka and Rosie get into more detail on some specific work that they're doing. But one of the other projects that Rosie, Professor Kretschmann on the ground is focusing on is part of our microbial metabolic exploration work where we're looking for microbes that aid in detoxification and immobilization of chrome 6. And in the lab work in the microcosms, we've achieved unprecedented rates for reduction of chrome 6 to chrome 3, initially working with microcosms and stimulating microbial growth and achieving reduction on the order of hours. And then, interestingly, about a year after stimulating the microbes, we finished stimulating the microbes, we re-injected the microcosms with chromium and had remediation rates on the order of minutes rather than hours. And we don't really completely understand these the mechanism for that. We're looking into it. It's obviously related to the microbes that we generated, but it doesn't seem to be related to microbial growth. And so we're trying to understand that and then figure out how we can mobilize that for remediation purposes. I mentioned a couple of times so far our microbial crust restoration work. Professor Garcia-Piquel, who's the lead investigator, calls this microbial restoration, where we're going in and restoring the natural microbial crust in areas that have been disturbed by anthropogenic activities. It could be mining, it could be forest fire, it could be off-road motorcycles. And we've built a field deployable microbial nursery that we can move to the site and use that to develop inoculum that are site-specific, that are grown in the environmental conditions at the site that they're adapted to, and then deploy them and recreate these crusts in a matter of months that take decades and hundreds, sometimes hundreds of years to establish themselves. Another remediation project we're working on is on removal of nitrogen and phosphorus from ground and surface water, basically water impacted by agricultural development. And we do this with a combination of processes. The phosphate is removed by precipitation, by inducing flow through steel slag, basic oxygen furnace slag, which is a very high pH material, highly buffered. This induces precipitation of the phosphorus, and then downstream, we use kind of a traditional wetlands approach to reduce the nitrate by denitrification. And the main contribution on this project is we've shown through laboratory testing that denitrification will still occur even under the elevated pH conditions that are induced by flowing through the steel slag. And we currently have a test section under construction at a farm in Wisconsin that is discharging into a lake that's subject to significant eutrophication. As soon as the weather permits, we'll finish construction of the test section and put that into practice. One of our colleagues at New Mexico State, Lambis Papelis, is working on microbially enhanced iron-modified zeolite permeable reactive barriers. And he's conducted column experiments with both selenium and arsenic. And here are some of the results showing the microbial transformation of selenium with selenite, 100% reduction, and selenate, depending on the flow rate, from 50% to 100% removal. And we have geochemical modeling and microbial ecology analysis underway to understand these processes, as well as parallel column testing on arsenic. Professor Delgado, who you'll hear from a little bit later, has an ongoing project on passive remediation of acid rock drainage via coupled treatment, again, using slag, basic oxygen furnace slag, and an organic substrate for bioreduction and metal removal from acid rock drainage. She's evaluated two different organic substrates, sugarcane bagasse and sprent rearing grains, evaluated the effect of the slag on the chemistry both before and after the bioreduction, and in columns that you see on the right-hand side of the slide, she's achieved substantial sulfate reduction metal removal with both the brewing grains and the sugarcane bagasse. Most metal removal is greater than 90%, and this is even under relatively high flow rates and short retention times in the column. Professor Delgado, I should have had her name on this slide, is also the senior investigator on the microbial chain elongation project. As I noted before, this is where the microorganisms under anaerobic conditions build simple substrates into larger, more complex molecules. This facilitates bioremediation via biostimulation by the addition of organic and inorganic carbon. She tested a variety of different soils, and this process was shown to occur in all of the soil microcosms tested, although the end product differed by the soil type. But I think in every case, there were high concentrations of hydrogen liberated in the soil to provide energy for bioremediation. I mentioned the work that we're doing on carbonate precipitation for liquefaction and that it has some potential environmental applications. Mineral precipitation phenomena, of course, are very common in nature, calcium carbonate precipitation being one of the most common, perhaps salt is the other one. In biogeotechnical engineering, it's the most studied because it provides increased strength, stiffness, and dilatancy to the soil. It reduces the permeability of the soil. And from an environmental perspective, we can co-precipitate some contaminants with the calcium carbonate. There are many calcium carbonate precipitation mechanisms. Some are anthropogenic, and some, at least, are beneficial from a liquefaction perspective because they generate biogas, which leads to desaturation, which is a liquefaction mitigation mechanism. So we're heavily invested in carbonate precipitation because of the many potential applications. Besides liquefaction mitigation, we're using it for fugitive dust and erosion control by stabilizing the surface soil through biocementation. It has potential applications for creating subsurface barriers. We've looked at precipitating the calcium carbonate in the presence of bentonite slurry, and it forms very strong and very low permeability barriers. Co-precipitation of contaminants, I mentioned, it has other infrastructure applications, for instance, in slope stabilization and replacing Portland cement for making building materials and supporting foundations, which can help mitigate the greenhouse gas impacts of Portland cement production. So there are a variety of different processes for calcite precipitation, and two that we are using in our center are microbially induced calcite precipitation and enzyme induced calcite precipitation. And both of these precipitations induce biocementation via hydrolysis of urea. So we either mix the enzyme with a solution of urea and calcium chloride or stimulate urolytic microbes in the presence of a solution of urea and calcium chloride. The urea is hydrolyzed, creating the carbonate ions that combine with calcium ions and precipitate as calcium carbonate, preferably as calcite. And the main difference between these two processes is, in one case, the urease enzyme that catalyzes precipitation is provided by microbes, and in another case, we extract it from a relative of the soybean called the jack bean that turns out to be perhaps the most prolific source, agricultural source of urease, although all green vegetation possesses urease to some extent. So we have to provide the urea and calcium chloride, and we've shown this can provide a viable alternative to Portland cement for cementing soils for a variety of purposes. Fugitive dust mitigation. Fugitive dust is a major environmental problem in the southwest United States and in other arid areas throughout the world. The best available technology, at least for short-term mitigation, is run the water truck and construction sites in Arizona in the summer. The water truck operates from dawn till dusk, 6 days a week. Well, when it's 110 degrees Fahrenheit and it's 20% relative humidity, you can run the water truck until the cows come home, and it's not going to be very effective. On the other hand, by using a solution with our enzyme-induced carbonate precipitation substrates, we have what we think is a one-and-done solution. One pass of the site will cement the superficial soil, and unless you disturb it mechanically, it will provide significant mitigation of fugitive dust for weeks to months. And we have field trials this month that will be starting with collaboration from three of our industry partners, Freeport-McMoRan, Republic Services, and the Salt River Landfill. And on this slide, we're looking at some charts showing the effectiveness of our solutions at increasing the threshold detachment velocity, the wind speed at which fugitive dust will be generated, bare soil being the problem, water being the business-as-usual solution. The green bars are just a salt solution, which is a typical solution on many mining sites. And then the black bars are the mitigation that we achieve with our calcium carbonate precipitation. Those black bars are capped at 25 meters per second because that's the maximum safe speed in our wind tunnel. But we're actually providing significantly more erosion resistance than that. And if our target is to be as effective as water, we can reduce substrate concentrations and make the process even more economical. I mentioned co-precipitation of contaminants. In particular, there's been a lot of work on sequestration of radionuclides via MITP. This isn't work that we're doing at our center, but at INEL and at the Hanford site, I believe there are field trials on this technology. But basically, any divalent radionuclide or metal should co-precipitate with calcium carbonate. And then one more project on infrastructure. One of our colleagues at Davis, Jason DeYoung, is working on biofilms for seepage control, providing a temporary barrier to seepage, for instance, for construction excavation. The nice thing about this technology is that it's self-equilibrating. As the biofilm develops and reduces the permeability and the high permeability zones, the seepage paths are shifted into the remaining high permeability zones. So to a certain extent, it's self-equilibrating, and in the work at Davis, they've shown that we can reverse it by starving biofilms. The soil will permeability, three-order magnitude decrease during treatment, then maintaining that for a substantial period of time, then starving the bacteria, the biofilms, having the permeability restore itself, and then reintroducing the nutrients decreasing the permeability. And then finally, I mentioned we're developing these self-boring robots. We actually have three different groups, Doug Cortez at New Mexico State, David Frost at Georgia Tech, and Julian Tao at ASU, developing these self-boring robots using different biological analogs. Professor Tao at ASU is developing a little probe that uses the razor clam for inspiration. Dr. Frost looks at how ants tunnel through the ground, and Dr. Cortez uses worms as inspiration for his probes. And they all have small, soft-bodied robots under development that will tunnel on their own through the soil, perhaps providing us with an opportunity to do enhanced subsurface investigation in contaminated zones, in that there's no spoil left behind. And so it minimizes the environmental impacts of tunneling in contaminated soils. So that's really just a snapshot, very quick snapshot, of some of the things that we're doing. You know, we believe there are many potential biogeotechnical applications of environmental protection, some of which are under investigation, and many more that are waiting to be explored. And so that concludes my presentation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, or if there aren't any, we could move on to the next presentation.
Well, sure. So, Ed, we've had a number of questions and comments that have come in, and I think I'll just summarize the questions. A lot of people have interest in some of the projects you've highlighted, and they wanted to know where they might be able to go to follow on, to learn more, or to perhaps reach out to some of your investigators. Do you maintain a place or a website where you talk about the various projects and where potential partners could reach out to you?
Good question, and it prompts me to point out an error on our slides. At the bottom of the slide, you'll see it says biogeotechnics.org. That was our website, but unfortunately, somebody else licensed it, and we had to switch. So we're now biogeotechnics.tech, T-E-C-H. So if you go to www.biogeotechnics.tech, you'll get much more information on our program, the various research projects we have, and the contact information for senior investigators and for the center management.
Okay. All right. Well, I think perhaps in the interest of time, we've got approximately 1 hour left in the webinar. We should move on to the other presentations, but we will pause again to take additional questions. So for those of you who have sent in some very specific questions, don't worry, I'll hold them in the queue, but we will pause again. And so I'm going to call up the next presentation, if that's all right. And I believe we'll go ahead and transition to our very next speaker. So Dr. Rosie, I believe is what I heard Ed referring to, but Dr. Kroshmolnik, are you ready to begin?
I'm ready.
All right, please do.
Okay, good afternoon. I'm Dr. Rosa Kroshmolnik-Brown, and I'm happy to talk to you today about hydrogen-based microbial interactions for successful bioremediation. Can you see the pointer?
We can. I'll
click on the arrow again.
Can you see it?
The dragon.
What? Where? I just want to put a pointer.
Sorry, right? Click again.
Again? There you go. There's an arrow now. Okay, great. All right, so today I'm going to talk to you about thoroethanes in groundwater. I'm going to talk really briefly about the problem because I know most of our viewers probably know about the problem. We're going to talk about bio-inspired and bio-mediated solution, some contributions from my lab towards enhancing this bio-inspired solution and new hydrogen-based insights. Usually I like to also talk about some applied case, but today Dr. Delgado will do that right after me. Chloroethanes are abundant in the groundwater in the United States. There's many U.S. Superfund sites that are contaminated with PCE and TCE. We know that there's more than 1,000 Superfund sites you can see in the map here, and that about 60% are polluted with these chlorinated solvents. We know that in the environment, we naturally have organic compounds and halogenated compounds that can naturally combine through biogenic or geogenic activity to produce halogenated organics. This happens naturally in the environment. And because this happens naturally in the environment, nature also has microbes that can do the halogenation and separate these organic compounds from the allergens through a process that we call dealoretheation, reductive chlorination. The problem is that we have shifted the balance of what nature would usually have through our anthropogenic input. And because this balance has been disturbed, we need to help nature a little bit by stimulating these microbes and providing some solutions so they can continue doing their job and cleaning the groundwater. The process of reductive chlorination is a process that microorganisms can use to obtain energy. They use chlorinated solvents like PCE and PCE as electron acceptors, like we use oxygen. And by doing this, they replace chlorines at each step of the reaction with hydrogen. This usually occurs under anaerobic conditions, and hydrogen is the electron donor. The Allococcoides macartii are the only microbes that are capable of detoxifying these chlorinated compounds all the way to ethane, or that's what we know. These microorganisms are usually abundant in the environment. My group has done a lot of work with the Allococcoides, understanding what are their needs and what are the ways that we can enhance their dechlorination and what are the ways that we can bring them to the lab from the environment and have good cultures that would allow to do this function. So what we usually do, we go into the environment, we bring sediments, we stimulate the sediments with chlorinated solvents, which eventually end up dechlorinating if it's the right sediment and the right conditions. And we usually look at who are the microbes there. Is there something else that we can do also with these microorganisms? So this is part of our approach of metabolic exploration also. Here I'm showing some data that was produced actually by Dr. Delgado sitting next to me during her PhD, where we had sediments from different environments that were what we would call pristine environments, and a sediment also from a contaminated site, which is the pericyclic sediment. And once we brought the sediments into the laboratory, Dr. Delgado stimulated them with TCE, which in all these graphs you will see TCE in blue, CCE in purple, and ethane when it's produced in green. And they were stimulated with electron donors, lactate and methanol. On our first simulation, you can see that on the two sediments that didn't come from a contaminated site, we only saw production of CZC, which is not ideal. This is not what we want. With our contaminated site, we saw ethane. During my PhD, I probably would have trashed these microcosms and autoclave them, but Dr. Delgado was more creative and she transferred them. And by transferring them and creating a culture that didn't have any more soil in it, a sediment-free culture, she was able to see complete dechlorination in all of this. And eventually, not only complete dechlorination, but pretty fast rates of complete dechlorination all the way to ethane, which is what you can see here with all three sediments. We look at the microbial ecology of these sediments and the resulting cultures, and there's a few things that I want to point your attention to. First of all, we have here the soils on the outside of this disc and the chlorinating culture in the middle. First thing I want you to notice is that on most of these donuts, you do not see any green, which is our Dialococcoidea, which are our microbes that do the dechlorination all the way to ethane in the soil. But when we stimulate this with ECE and with the right nutrients, you can see that a fraction of the microbes actually are now the Dialococcoidea, which are the chlorinator. You can see that in all three cultures. You can see that they're a bigger fraction in our culture from the contaminated site. And on the bottom, you can see the chlorination rates. And you can see that this culture, which is there at 10, which you will also hear more from Dr. Delgado later using this culture for a treatability study, was able to reduce TCE, 0.6 millimolar TCE in less than 2 days, all the way to ethane. We saw similar rates with our culture arena, and our culture that came from the contaminated site from Paris, Thailand, actually was not the fastest. Also, I want to point your attention to the fact that a higher percentage of relative abundance of the Allococcoides does not mean higher dechlorination rates for these cultures. And so now we were able to see that with these sediments, we could not see complete reductive dechlorination when we just added stimulants, when we just tried to biostimulate. There was no complete dechlorination. But one of the things that we wanted to see was, okay, now we have these cultures that have a high number of the Allococcoides. What happens if we put this culture back into the soil? Was there maybe an inhibitor that was not allowed or would inhibit the dechlorination if we were trying to do the dechlorination on the same soil? And so here we show that if we put the culture that came from the same soil back into the soil, we're able to see complete dechlorination at a slower rate than what we saw in our sediment-free cultures, but we're able to see complete dechlorination in both cases. And so this is exciting, but the more exciting question is what happened? Why couldn't we see dechlorination initially? And why is this dechlorination slower when we have the sediment in the culture than when we have a sediment-free culture? And of course, as scientists, we always have hypotheses. And our hypothesis is that there are competing processes in these soils that are taking over and they are capturing the hydrogen, which is the electron donor for the Allococcoides. And by capturing that hydrogen and competing against the Allococcoides, we probably can see reductive dechlorination initially just by stimulation. And it probably slows down a little bit when we bioaugment also because or the Allococcoides, even when they come at high concentrations, have to compete with other microbes and other microbial processes in order to do the dechlorination. So this schematic shows you that hydrogen and acetate, which are main electron donors for microbes, can be used as electron donor for many processes that we naturally see in our soils, and we will see it also in our contaminated groundwater and soils, bicarbonate reduction to methane, bicarbonate reduction also to acetate, iron reduction, sulfate reduction, nitrate reduction, and of course here we have our dechlorination, and sometimes we might also have perchlorate reduction. You can see also here some of the genes that we normally track, even though I'm not going to show genes today, I'm going to show chemicals. And so following up this question, I have a PhD student right now exploring the question of where is this hydrogen going in soils that have PPE or not, or in soils that we would call soils and sediments pristine. So can we quantify what is this hydrogen demand in the subsurface, and can we potentially use this as an indicator of potential dechlorination for the soil? And so the objective of this was to track this hydrogen consumption in a variety of soils and sediments, and hopefully to be able to see which electron accepting processes dominate when we have excess hydrogen. So what Meg Altizer, who is our PhD student working on this, did is she took 15 different soils and sediments, and in these soils and sediments there was naturally either nitrate, sulfate, organic carbon, iron. We didn't add that. And also naturally inorganic carbon. And what she did was she added hydrogen. We measure all these potential electron acceptors at time zero, and then she added hydrogen, and she measured hydrogen once a week, and whenever the hydrogen was depleted, she re-added hydrogen to make sure that there was always hydrogen available in these microcosms, and she did this for 100 days. And what we saw was that we have, of course, different soils that have different processes, and we're trying to see where are these hydrogen electrons going. And in this graph, what you can see is the change in the electron acceptors that we're showing here. So it's a delta. It's the change between time zero and 100 days. You can see this soil number 15, for example, has a lot of nitrate and some iron. Then we have soils that have a lot of inorganic carbon, which you can see over here. We have another two that have nitrate and some with inorganic carbon. And on the bottom, you can see how much hydrogen she added over those 100 days based on what was depleted. And our expectation and hypothesis would have been that if Since everything is presented in electron equivalents, the concentration of hydrogen added in electron equivalents should be similar to the bars that we're graphing in here. However, to our surprise, it wasn't. We had a different trend than what we would have predicted just based on electron acceptors. If we look at the processes just as a fraction of the hydrogens that were added, you can see on the right side that we have a lot of methanogenesis, and on the left side, and a few soils that have nitrate reduction, and on the left side, we have acidogenesis going on. So we can separate these two soils into the soils into two groups, one that is a methanogenic group, and one is that a group that produces more acetate. And these are always lined up in increasing what we would call hydrogen demand. So the soils that had higher methane accumulation are the soils that actually took much hydrogen when the hydrogen demand was being measured, and the soils that have higher acetate accumulation are the ones that we would call the soils with lower hydrogen demand. And so if we look again at our electron acceptors and the hydrogen demand, and we say, okay, if we look at the delta of these electron acceptors and our hydrogen demand, and we say, is there a correlation between these two? It's actually not bad. We have a correlation of 0.87. You know, this is I would say, pretty decent. So even though this seems decent, when we look at our electrons and where are they going, even though that correlation seems kind of okay, we know that we're missing processes here. If we look at the percentage of fraction of electrons, we're measuring in some of our soils less than 50% of what we should be measuring. Well, about 50%, because this box is actually higher than it should be. It probably should be at about 0.8%, because we also have hydrogen electrons going to biomass formation. So that could account from 10 to 20%. But we're still missing a lot of electrons here that we don't know where they're going. So that was the next question that we asked. And when we looked at that, two other processes that we looked at were organic carbon, based on organic carbon. So we have production of medium chain fatty acids, which is this process of chain elongation that Dr. Kamapanjan mentioned before. And do we have maybe humic reduction? And if we measure these two processes that are related to the organic carbon in our samples, can we get closer to a balance of electrons? And if we're trying to get to 0.8, we can see that by adding this production of medium chain fatty acids and by adding the humic reduction, we're getting closer to being able to predict where all this hydrogen is going into the environment. And if we look at the correlation between the total organic carbon and our hydrogen demand, we have a pretty good correlation also, 0.86. So we know that some of the electrons that are being added are going also to processes that relate to organic carbon, not just to the other electron accepting processes that we were considering. Okay, this is nice, but here is the overall picture of what we think is going on. So in soils where we have not introduced in these soils any TC or PC yet, we're just looking at what we think are the natural processes when there's no added electron donors. So when there's no added electron donors, we mainly have acetogenesis, methanogenesis, this humic reduction that could also in other processes like iron reduction. We have nitrate reduction and sulfate reduction. And we think that acetate produced by these processes also leads to a longer chain fatty acid or chain elongation. And why is this important, and how does this relate to our PC and TC dechlorination? So here I'm showing an experiment where we, I'm saying we, but it was really Meg, took these soils. She took two soils that were like low hydrogen demand and two soils that were like what we call high hydrogen demand. And in these soils, she looked at how would the chlorination of PCE happen, both on their stimulation and not stimulation with electron donors. And so on the top circles, first, you can see that when we add hydrogen and acetate to these soils, these two soils did not produce any ethane, and these two soils, the green, is the percentage of ethane produced. When we add lactate and methanol, we have a little bit more reductive dechlorination, which is what we usually do to stimulate these microbes. And again, the soil 14 on the very right is the best producing ethane. And more surprising, when we do not add any donor, these two soils, which were the two high hydrogen demanding soils, had conversion to ethane by themselves without adding any electron donor. I want you to call your attention also to the fact that these two soils that had chlorination by themselves without adding any electron donor also had a considerable amount of organic carbon, and when we measure the organic carbon in all 15 soils, this one was the highest in organic carbon. So what we think is happening here is that this organic carbon present already in the soil is serving us the electron donor. And we think that the processes that we showed on our hydrogen demanding study show that some of these organic carbon also can capture hydrogen that can later on maybe be released also for reductive dechlorination as a natural attenuation or polishing step after treatment. Some of the lessons learned, we have some robust enrichment process that we can use to produce microbes, and we've shown, even though I didn't show it today, that we can scale up and produce a lot of culture for application at sites. Inorganic carbon metabolism, acidogenesis and methanogenesis were dominant in most of the soils, and these might or not sound relevant, but I know that bicarbonate is also many times used in sites for adjustment of pH, and when that happens, this will actually contribute to this hydrogen demand, and it will be a competing process also for the chlorinators. And we also show that organic carbon and cumics can consume hydrogen also and perhaps release it later for processes like reductive dechlorination. I want to thank people that are in my lab and funding agencies and contributors. And I have a slide of questions, but in the interest of time, I'm going to give the remote to Dr. Anca Delgado, and we'll take questions at the end.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Anca Delgado. I'm an assistant professor at ASU. And as you saw, Dr. Krakmalnik-Brown gave a good introduction to bioremediation of chlorinated solvents and highlighted some fundamental studies that are actually required for the development and implementation of these technologies at contaminated sites. But my short talk today will focus a little bit on some fundamentals, and but has a more applied angle, as I will be talking about a treatability study that we did for one of the Superfund sites in the Phoenix metropolitan area. And that Superfund site is the Phoenix Goodyear Airport, and that site has been, it is about 17 miles west of downtown Phoenix in the county of Maricopa in Arizona. It has been added to the national priority list in 1983, and it has groundwater, and that is impacted mainly by trichloroethane and perchlorate. There was some occurrence of some heavy metals in certain areas in soils, but that has been mainly dealt with. And there are three subunits at this site, subunit A, B, and C, but for the purpose of our treatability study, we're mainly concerned with subunit A, which is an area that has interbedded sands, silty sands, and clay sands with some gravel and sand sequences. And the groundwater depth is 90 to 100 feet below ground surface. So to get a perspective of what has happened at the sites and has been put on the national priority list in 1983, well, there has been some extensive pump and treat system for actually a few decades, even on a limited scale, some in situ chemical reduction. And then, you know, due to the fact that these systems have been, pump and treat systems have been in place for many years, and we are not really seeing good contaminant reduction at the site, there has been a decision that has been reached to actually go after the store zone in subunit A. And part of that process, which is where our laboratory at ASU and CBDG is coming in, is to carry out a treatability study to gain insight onto to potentially take decisions about a field implementation at the Phoenix Goodyear Airport. And the vision for a potential treatment at the Phoenix Goodyear Airport actually include a combination of zero-valent iron and microbial reductive dechlorination. Now, zero-valent iron has been used for remediation of chlorinated solvents and has been applied at contaminated sites. And the conceptual framework is shown in this figure, and it is actually focused on using zero-valent iron to create a synergy between biotic and abiotic reactions. So we know that ZVI is a potent reductant, and it can actually reduce trichloroethene directly and form ethene and ethane through intermediate production of acetylene. We know that ZVI can actually reduce the oxygen, dissolve oxygen in the groundwater. This is particularly relevant for the Superfund site that has a highly aerobic aquifer. And in that reduction of dissolved oxygen, anaerobic conditions would be created that would be required for anaerobic microbial processes. When ZVI is reacting with water, there is production of molecular hydrogen, and molecular hydrogen, as you heard from Dr. Krahmalnik-Brown, is the only electron donor for reductive dechlorination of TC, DC, and vinyl chloride. And so that would be the electron donor that would be required for microbial processes. And lastly, as you see in this in the schematic, we also have the reaction of ZVI with water also produces hydroxides, which can counterbalance the protons produced from dechlorination and fermentation reactions. All right, so to evaluate this conceptual framework, we designed a series of microcosms and column studies. This was the work of two master students. One of them is shown here, Srivatsan Mohanarangan. And I will highlight the microcosm study first, and this was a big effort with many conditions tested, and we're only going to show here a few select conditions. But basically, we took a soil from the site and groundwater and set up microcosms with 25 grams of soil and 75 milliliters of groundwater. We actually operated these microcosms in semi-batch form. In after basically 14 days of incubation, we removed a third of the liquid content and replaced with fresh groundwater and amendments, and that is designated by the dashed vertical lines in each one of these panels, showing a beginning and an end of a semi-batch cycle. And I will first draw your attention to the middle panels where we used a high concentration of zero valent iron, that's 15 grams per liter of micro ZVI and 1.5 grams per liter of nano ZVI. And in these microcosms with very high concentration of EVI, we saw very rapid and complete reduction of the TCE to ethene and ethane with no intermediate production of dichloroethene and vinyl chloride. And the rates of these reactions and the fact that there were no intermediates formed gave us a strong indication that these were processes that were mainly dominated by abiotic reactions in which the ZVI was directly reducing the TCE to ethene and ethane. Now, when we used a low concentration of ZVI by just taking actually 2.5 milliliters of spent ZVI slurry from one of the high ZVI microcosms, We also saw very rapid reduction rates of the TC to ethene, but we also detected intermediate production of dichloroethene and vinyl chloride, giving us a good indication that we are starting now to see more of a synergy between abiotic and microbiological reactions when zero-valent iron was in low concentration. One other aspect that we evaluated was the effect of iron 2 on microbial processes, reductive dechlorination. Iron 2 is generated from the ZVI reaction in water. And as you see here in panels G, H, and I, in the presence of iron 2 when microbial cultures were added for bioaugmentation, we actually saw slower dechlorination rates compared to the processes with high ZVI or the processes without any iron, and gave us a good indication of what might happen as this iron 2 is being generated from the ZVI reaction. As I mentioned, for the Phoenix Goodyear Airport site, the two main contaminants are trichloroethene, and the second one would be perchlorate. We also evaluated the effect of zero-valent iron on perchlorate reduction. Perchlorate is in much lower concentration than TCE. Basically, big picture findings here, these are results from the microcosm study, is that perchlorate reduction was inhibited by iron, whether that was zero-valent iron or iron 2, but to a much greater extent by the zero-valent iron than by iron 2. And in the absence, actually, of any iron species in the microcosms in which we didn't add any iron, we actually saw the fastest rates of perchlorate reduction. Anytime zero-valent iron is being utilized, an important consideration is for bioaugmentation purposes is actually the survival of these microorganisms in the presence of ZVI. We know that microbial ZVI inhibition can occur through either a direct mechanism in which some strong reactive oxygen species can be generated, and these could disrupt the microbial cell wall, or there could be an indirect mechanism in which competing processes can take over if that hydrogen that's being generated from ZVI is taken over by maybe sulfate reducers or methanogens. And so we tracked the growth of the Halococcoides maccardii, the microorganisms that are doing the reductive dechlorination of TCE, in these microcosms with high ZVI concentrations, low ZVI, iron 2, and no iron species. And I think that some of the more pertinent conclusions here were that in the presence of very high ZVI concentrations of 15 grams per liter of macroscale and 1.5 grams per liter of nanoscale, we saw survival of the Halococcoides maccardii. And we actually saw growth by several orders of magnitude in the absence of the iron species. Another important conclusion here is that the direct inhibitory effects for which there is a body of literature in the absence of soil and groundwater were actually somewhat mitigated when we used soil from the site and groundwater compared to previous studies that have mainly focused on the effect of ZVI in the absence of site material. There is also very little evidence or little work out there on how zero-valent iron affects microbial community structure in the presence of soil and groundwater. So this is not these aspects are not completely understood. And we used high-throughput sequencing to understand the microbial community structure in these various microcosms with zero-valent iron and iron 2. And some of the key findings here is that we saw substantial differences between the microbial community that was present in the soil and groundwater without, the in situ sort of community, and when we added the zero-valent iron or the iron 2. And what has become obvious is that microbial enrichment from the group of the Halococcoidae here, this is where the Halococcoidae maccardii is part of, and some groups within Rhodospirecia and Rhodosticlesia which are perchlorate reducers, were enriched under various conditions stimulated in the microcosm. So the microcosm phase of the project gave us some good insight into the potential effect of ZVI at high concentration and low concentration on microbial reduction of PCE and perchlorate. But they also highlighted some limitations of the combined strategy, particularly if we use high concentrations of ZVI, where we saw mostly abiotic-dominated process, and the microorganisms really did not play a big role there. So it became obvious to us that more of a decoupled process would basically get a truer synergy between these processes. And in the second phase of the project, where we employed soil column studies, we tried to decouple the ZVI and the microbiological processes in the following fashion. So we kind of envisioned conceptually that perhaps at a site we can have the ZVI being injected in an injection well upstream, and then the microbial culture, bioaugmentation, biostimulation to occur somewhere downstream of the ZVI injection, or a sort of a ZVI barrier. And so here what I show, where we show as ZVI columns, this is a smaller column that's packed with soil that has ZVI added to that column, through which we're passing the groundwater from the site. We are collecting that groundwater, and then we are feeding it as influence to a set of columns that are just biostimulated and bioaugmented, in which we're hoping to stimulate the microbial processes. So this would be more of an abiotic-dominated system, and here would be more microbiologically-dominated system. And really briefly, I'll highlight the treatment of this aerobic groundwater within the ZVI column. One of the most important characteristics of this water is its oxidation reduction potential after being passed through that ZVI column. Initially, was very positive oxygen ORP at about 150 millivolts, and then it became very reduced below 0 millivolts, which is a good indication of good anoxic conditions. So now we take this reduced groundwater that passed through the ZVI column, and now we feed it to a larger set of columns that were in which we're hoping to stimulate the microbial processes. And this is an actual picture of the columns. Here would be that ZVI reduced groundwater was here in this container. And we also respiked the groundwater with some additional TC and tracked reductive dechlorination in the effluent of these biological columns. All right, so here are the key results. The three columns are presented here, and I zoomed one of them in so to get a better sense of the data. We have concentration on the y-axis and time on the x-axis here. And some key messages here would be that for basically a roughly 180 days, we did not do any biostimulation and bioaugmentation. We actually started seeing TC effluent come through, but no, only TC. No byproducts were detected. No signs of microbial activity without biostimulation and bioaugmentation. And that would be the blue symbols in this graph. And then around the day 180, we biostimulated with lactate and emulsified vegetable oil. We also bioaugmented with two microbial cultures, ZARA-10, which Dr. Kahmalik talked about, that was developed at ASU, and SDC-9, which is the commercially available culture. And within just one hydraulic retention time, which was about roughly 14 days, we saw significant production of cis dichloroethene and vinyl chloride and ethene. Now, somewhere around day 260, we saw some decreased rates of TC dechlorination. We saw TC actually come out of the effluent of these columns, and we suspected and did some measurements, and we suspected an electron donor and carbon source limitation, and we were correct. We biostimulated again around day 280 and immediately recovered the rates of TCE reduction to all the way to ethene, and we were able to sustain that until the end of the experiment. So complete TCE reduction to ethene. As Rosie mentioned, in the natural soil sediments and groundwater, besides our contaminants of interest, we also already have naturally occurring constituents that serve as electron acceptors for competing microorganisms. And one of them that's really relevant for this particular site is sulfate. Sulfate at the site is about at 1 gram per liter, so quite high concentration. And when we did an analysis, an electron balance, tried to understand where the electrons were going that we were feeding as lactate and multiplied vegetable oil to the processes occurring in these columns, whether that's reductive dechlorination, methane, perchlorate reduction, we actually saw that more than 50% of our electrons were going to sulfate reduction. And sulfate reduction was quite extensive in these columns and basically taking away many of those electrons that we fed as fermentable substrate. Another key message or observation from these columns was the pH at which reductive dechlorination and perchlorate reduction was occurring in these biological columns. So as you may remember, we take aerobic groundwater, we pass it through the ZVI column, we reduce it, and then we feed that to the biological columns. And the influent pH from that ZVI reduced groundwater was around 7.8, but the actual effluent pH of the columns was more close to 8.5 to 9. So this is quite a high pH at which these reactions were occurring. And one of the reasons why pH was likely going up so substantially in these biological columns was sulfate reduction, which is actually a process that consumes protons in the system. And because we have such substantial sulfur reduction, we would also see this very high pH increase. However, I have to note that regardless of that very high pH, we still saw very good performance of reductive dechlorination of TC all the way to effluent. We also gather evidence on the colonization of the soil matrix in these columns by the Helicobacter macardii, and we saw basically concentrations of up to 10 to the 6th cells per gram of soil, and which correlated really well with the chemical performance that we were monitoring in these columns. And then lastly, one last question we tried to address with this project is what would happen once the ZVI were to be spent at the site and were no longer active? Would we be able to keep these reducing this TCE by just stimulating the microorganisms without the contribution of ZVI? So then we took the columns that were previously stimulated with that ZVI-reduced water, and we stopped feeding ZVI-reduced water. We just fed aerobic groundwater that was directly collected from the site. And we biostimulated with the fermentable substrate, lactate, and emulsified vegetable every 2 weeks. And as you can see from these graphs, the green symbols, the same symbols that Dr. Krachmalnik used for ethene, basically we were able to maintain very good TC reductive dechlorination rate all the way to ethene without any obvious accumulation of intermediate byproducts, implying that this strategy is potentially a good one for maintaining this sort of good microbiological activity that we had initially established with the contribution of the ZVI. All right, so with that, I will just give you the main big picture lessons from this treatability study. We saw that abiotic TC reduction to ethene and ethane was highly effective at high ZVI concentrations, that microbial perchlorate reduction was partially inhibited at high ZVI concentration and to a lesser extent when iron 2 was present. The microbial TCE reduction was a significant process when we used low concentrations of ZVI. And at high ZVI concentration, microbial reduction, reductive dechlorination was not as significant because that process was mainly dominated by the iron 2, by the ZVI abiotic reduction. And we were able to see a pretty good synergy between abiotic and biotic processes in the column study, we were even able to achieve similar outcomes in terms of that complete TC to ethene reductive dechlorination, even in the absence of ZVI by just biostimulating these columns. All right, with that, we will thanks for your attention. I want to obviously thank the team that was involved in this project, particularly the PI, Rosa Kasmali Brown, our students and our sponsors, and CBBG, of course, Matrix New World, and ASU. And with that, we all thank you here, and we'll be happy to answer questions to any of the presentations given today.
All right. Thank you so very much. I'll just remind the audience that they can submit comments or questions if they haven't done so for our speakers using that Q&A window, which appears in the lower right corner of your screen. I'm going to start with some of the questions that came in earlier, and I believe this question was directed at you, Dr. Krasmalnik. The participants were just curious at different soil types, if you had investigated soil types from across the U.S. or just at a few locations in the same sort of geographic region. Can you talk a bit about the spread of where you may have collected your soil samples from?
So the soils are from across the U.S., from Canada, and that's it, right? Puerto Rico, but Puerto Rico is the U.S. So across the U.S., including Puerto Rico and Canada.
Okay. All right. And they were curious if you had done any cost estimates of what some of the augmentations to the soil microbes would come at or how much you spent doing the modifications to those populations.
Can you...
Cost.
Repeat the question. Cost for what? For what?
Remediation.
Yeah, for remediation. So you obviously were studying some of those populations. You had noted that there were modifications made to populations, or you were combining soil microbes from different populations to then get to certain chemical reactions. And they're just curious if there were cost estimates of what augmentations to the soil microbes would cost to actually deploy these approaches.
We've made some calculations. Do you remember, Anka? I don't remember right now, but we've made some calculations. So if needed to, I can follow up.
Okay.
I don't have the number at hand, but if needed to, if someone follows up, we'll be happy to follow up. We've made some calculations. And, of course, it's not just the cost of producing the microbes, then it's the cost of taking them to the field and what it costs to monitor at the field, of course.
We also had a question for you, Dr. Delgado. One of the participants wanted to know if you've researched in your delivery mechanisms. They state that in ideal conditions in the lab are great, but in the field we often have subsurface conditions that make delivery of injections or other materials into the subsurface really challenging to do consistently. Have you done any research into how sensitive some of these reactions or processes were to variations in your delivery mechanism?
We did not address those factors per se, and our involvement in this project was mainly in the laboratory doing the treatability study. However, we did look at some aspects in the laboratory that might be indicative of potential delivery issues in the at the field. For example, we monitored clogging, we monitored flow through in the soil columns. We have to say that running soil columns with clay soils from the site was a bit challenging, and it's good that it was challenging because this really gives us an indication for what we might expect in the field, and so it took some a while to establish reliable flow through to these columns. We didn't have too many clogging issues. We operated these columns for more than 300 days, so that was a good indication that clogging may not necessarily be a very pertinent issue based on our laboratory studies.
We had another question on one of the bar charts. You were talking about the different processes, and you mentioned that the sulfate process seemed to be one of the most dominant ones. The participant wanted to know if you have any guesses on what those unaccounted processes were, because in some cases it seemed like that was almost as significant as the sulfate one.
Yeah, so not accounted in that electron balance are microbial growth and the electrons that are going to grow to make cells, cell synthesis, so that could account for another 10 to 20%, which reduces some of that unaccounted a little bit. We don't have any other good idea on where the other accounted might be at this point. We looked at...
There's not a lot of organics, I remember.
Yeah, there aren't a lot of organics in this soil, so unlike some of the soils that Dr. Krahmelnik presented that have a high organic content, this this soil from the site is quite poor in organic content. And we've accounted for what we thought were the main microbial processes there, which would be the dechlorination reactions, TCE perchlorate, nitrate reduction, sulfate reduction, and methanogenesis. So so at this point, we don't have a good indication of where else those might, those electrons might be going to.
But there are other metals, right? They could be going to other metals.
Rosie, Dr. Krahmelnik Brown is commenting that maybe there are some the metals that are present in the site, maybe even natural iron species mm-hmm. that we have did not necessarily directly measure in this case.
All right, excellent. Thank you. They had a question in reference to slide number 12. Dr. Delgado, they mentioned that they may have missed it, but why didn't you collect any data between days 75 and 140?
That was the, yeah. Okay, so we did collect data. We actually took these columns and we were flowing groundwater and TCE to start establishing flow-through conditions. We actually did a series of breakthrough curves and did some investigations on to determine porosity, et cetera. And so the first, let's say, roughly 45 days and then all the way to about day 135 or so were dedicated to studies that focused more on the properties of the soil and the response of TCE being fed into these columns. And those were not shown there purposely to kind of minimize the amount of data that and the amount of information presented in these studies.
Okay. Somebody had asked if, based off of the treatability study, is this approach going to be used at the site?
That would be a recommendation, but it's not up to us.
Okay. All right.
You want to say something else?
I think the remedial strategy is being discussed with the involved parties and, of course, the Environmental Protection Agency. And I think right now, as we stand, bioremediation is still a strong option on the table, supported by some of these results. But we are not aware as of right now of the definitive plan at the site.
I want to add to that answer that bioremediation seemed to be something really that maybe was not going to happen at all at the site because this site is aerobic and has a lot of sulfate, so we didn't even know if we were going to be able to enhance bioremediation. And this study is beautiful because we were able to demonstrate that we can, just by reducing the groundwater, just by reducing the ORP in the aquifer, we can really push bioremediation even under these challenging conditions. And also that when we use bioremediation, we can get the chlorination both of TCE and perchlorate.
Okay. All right. We did have another question about the results from this study. I think this is sort of following on earlier where people were asking where they could learn more. Are there articles or plans to publish the work where someone can follow on and learn in more detail this type of treatability study?
Yes, we definitely have plans to publish this work. There's an available thesis by one of the master students that work on this project that is publicly available, and we have a manuscript that's ready for submission hopefully in the very near future. So stay tuned for that.
All right, excellent. And We did have a question that came in earlier. Ed, I'm going to go back. It was one of the examples you had brought up about a microbial crust. And some of the participants had asked if you could expand on the microbial crusts and what they might be used for. Are they surviving long-term, or you just know that you can create them and you don't know how long they live?
Sure. So I'll answer a little bit, and then maybe Rosie can elaborate. But these are natural crusts that form. These are crusts that form naturally over time, and that then get destroyed by anthropogenic activities. So once they're reestablished, assuming they're adapted to the site environmental conditions, yes, they should persist long term. Rosie, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, that's the idea. And just to give a little bit more information, these are usually cyanobacterial, you know, microbial crust.
Okay. All right. So I don't see any other questions right now in the queue. I'll just wait another moment here because we do have a few minutes left remaining. But while I am waiting to see if any other questions come in, I wanted to express gratitude to our presenters who joined us today and shared their expertise. We've had a number of people send in messages just thanking us and thanking you for sharing your expertise. I also want to thank the nearly 140 people who chimed in. We had a number of international participants as well for today's live broadcast. If you have additional questions, now would be the time to type those into the Q&A window. But just in case we happen to have someone who comes up with a question later on, for our three presenters, are they okay to reach out to you later on should they come up with a question or wish to follow up with some of the research that you presented?
Certainly. We would welcome that.
Okay. And I have seen a couple of questions in here asking if you are looking for research partners. So I'm going to just suggest those of you who are interested in research partners, again, to follow up on that offer and to reach out to our presenters directly. I do see one last question that came in, and this participant has asked, are you exploring point source treatment for generators? They say that some of these technologies seem easier to implement before the contamination enters the environment. So rather than, you know, augmenting these microbe populations in the soil now that the contamination has been released, have you considered getting to that contamination before it even hits the ground?
I think source control is always preferable to coming in after the fact and dealing with the problem that it creates.
But we have not considered.
But we don't have any research directly addressing that.
And I guess if someone did have some ideas, they could certainly reach out to you as well. One of the
absolutely, and just to elaborate, yes, we're always looking for partners at all levels. You know, providing us with sites where we can do experimentation, collaborating on research, and that's what it's called the industry partner program. But you know, that's a broad term for anybody who wants to collaborate with us.
We did have another question that came in, and this is regarding the types of cultures you were using. One of our participants noted that you can buy cultures commercially for some of these microbe populations, and they wondered if you could talk about the benefits of sort of growing something that's site-specific to use versus buying an off-the-shelf culture.
I'll take a first stab at this. A potential benefit for growing a site-specific culture versus buying a commercially available culture is the ability to enrich the microorganisms that were already present at the site that are already acclimated or to some extent acclimated to the environmental conditions. Now, this could be conditions such as either a very low, more acidic pH or a more alkaline pH, or conditions in which other groundwater constituents, metals, etc., are already present and potentially could have toxic effects, which the native microbes are already have found mechanisms to deal with these inhibitory effects. However, I think in terms of an actual field demonstrations of the benefits of a site-specific culture versus a commercially available culture are limited. Those kind of investigations are not really, or that kind of information is not readily available. Until we have an actual study that investigates this to say one way or the other, we definitely see benefits, but there's also, you know, time and work involvement in developing a culture that's site-specific.
I want to add quickly that we did this for research purposes for fundamental science, but the Zera culture we actually sent to a site in New Jersey. I didn't present that because of the interest of time, and we showed that there was a very good reductive decontamination and depletion of the contaminant at that site. So the objective of this presentation was not to show that you can do it with a culture from each site, but that we have the capability of producing this cultures that are really efficient and good.
And in the New Jersey work, that was the site-specific culture that you developed?
It was Zera. It was the same culture that we used for PGAN for this Superfund site. We sent, 100 liters of culture, and they injected it, and within a few months, we could see depletion of the TCE on the groundwater, which was great.
And again, follow-on question, has that site work been published as well?
It hasn't.
Will it be?
We should publish it somewhere. You know? It's just the...
Yeah, we have information from the collaborator company on the performance and the reduction in the plume, PC plume concentration and growth of the Dihalococcoides, but we did not turn that into a...
Yeah, it would have to be a short note because the information is not what we consider enough for a, you know, scientific journal publication.
Okay. Well, it certainly seems like the audience has interest in a number of these projects and these cultures. And on that note, we have reached our scheduled end time. So I'd like to just walk through a few quick closing reminders before we formally conclude today's live broadcast. Again, please, I want to be sure to thank all of our presenters who took time out of their schedules to share their work and their expertise and help address your questions. I also want to thank the nearly 140 individuals who joined us for today's live broadcast. As we highlighted at the start of the webinar, we did provide presentation materials and resources on the seminar resources or links page. You'll find that on the middle right under related URLs, and I've also included it in the